Earl Compton. I was born February 18, 1905, in Ida County, North Carolina, by good parents who lived on rented land. That is, we did sharecropping. The party that owned the land got a part, and the folks that worked the land got a part. Up until 1910, my parents bought a little farm where they lived the rest of their life. In those days, there were no automobiles, there were no telephones, no electricity, or running water, a thing like this, out in the country. There were no highways. We just go from little trails from farm to farm. And there was a dirt road from town to town, which wasn't much of a road. They didn't have any way to work it. In those days, they didn't even have farm tractors, let alone road working equipment. My parents loved to go to church. It was about 10 to 12 miles just through the dirt trails through the country. It was a long day's drive to go to Pleasant Hill Church. My dad would hook a team of little mules to a two-horse wagon, put some straw or hay in the back of the wagon to put the kids on. Mom and Dad would set up on the seat and drive the mules. So when we would get to church, Dad would unhitch the mules from the wagon, tie one to each rear wheel of the wagon in the back on each side, and feed the mules in the wagon. So after church was over, we'd go out and have dinner on the ground. I guess you've heard the expression of dinner on the ground. Well, that's what we had. They'd spread sheets down on the ground, put the food on it, stoop over and get the food, stand around, eat the food, enjoy the love and the fellowship, talk about the good meeting. Sometimes they would do some singing out on the ground. So after the visitation, we'd hitch the mule back to the wagon, head back home. Sometimes it would be late in the afternoon or even dark when we'd get back home, but we'd think we'd had a wonderful day. When I become a teenager, my dad had an old watch that had been found out in the field on a new ground where it had been burned over. The case was black, and the crystal had been heated to the extent that it had melted and sunk in part way down to the hands. It was one of those big old 18-size Elgin watches, a 7-jewel with a crystal almost a quarter of an inch thick. So it was popular in its day. It was the largest pocket watch at that time available. The next smaller size was a railroad size watch, which was a 16. Then he had a 12 size dress watch. But this happened to be one of the old big 18 size 7-jewel Elgins. So my dad took the old watch to Statesville to a watchmaker, and he got the watch open, found the movement apparently in good condition. No moisture got in to cause rust or corrosion. And he cleaned it up. It had, of course, the oil got gooey and sticky, and it wouldn't run. So he got the watch going. So it only run for a short period of time till it stopped. So my dad would take it back to town whenever he'd be going to back to Statesville. And sometimes it was running by the time he got there. Sometimes it wasn't. He'd leave it. The man would work on it. Well, in no time, it just keep doing the same thing, running and stopping, just running and stopping. Apparently he didn't find the trouble, but after our no experience on watches at all, we figured out that probably the heat and when the watch was burned over had loosened up the roller jewel, which is the little jewel that connects the roller table to the pallet fork, and it was loose. So we'd had to watch part many times before we discovered this. In the first place, our dad didn't allow us to fool with the watch. But when he and Mom would go to town, he'd had drove a nail up over the mantel, over the fireplace in the old farmhouse, way up toward the ceiling where he thought that the kids couldn't get it. But we would stack up chairs. One would hold the chairs. One would climb up and get the watch down. we knew about what time they would get back. So we'd had to watch apart many times before we really found the trouble. This little roller jewel, which wasn't there when we discovered where it had been, we didn't even know there was such a thing. Apparently it was loose, and we had lost it out in opening and closing it so many times that we had lost the part. So we discovered there was a little hole over in the roller table, which is right over the end of the pallet fork, which we didn't know what these parts were. There's a hole in this little part right over the end of that little forked thing underneath. So we felt probably there must be some kind of a connection between that little hole and that little forked thing. So Mom had a little small sewing needle, which we took it out to the old grind rock, ground half of it away, because this hole was a half round. It was flat on one side and half round on the other side. We ground half of that little needle away. So we pushed the needle into this little hole, the small portion of it, and broke it off where the little bump of it stuck out on the other side. So that would make contact to the pallet fork. So we put the watch back together, and it started going. Well, it ran beautiful. So after we had the watch going, we weren't afraid to let our dad know we had been working on his watch. So we told him we'd got the watch going, and he was very much surprised. And I think he just felt it would run for a little bit and stop. But it continued to go. He says, "Jim, you can wire it a day, and Howard can wire it a day back and forth for a little while for getting it going." Well, we was real proud of the watch. And we switched back and forth day by day. So in the meantime, Mr. Jim Overcash, one of the neighbors, he come over, and he had a little gold watch, a smaller, much smaller size, with a closed case that had a lid over the front. And there was a beautiful little gold 15-jewel Elgin. So my dad told him that the boys had got the watch running after the experience he'd had taking it to the watchmaker at Statesville. So Mr. Overcash said, well, he'd had a similar trouble with his. He could never keep it going. Take it to town, spend money on it. It would cost a whole dollar at that time to take a watch to the jeweler store. Well, that was 2 days' work. My dad, when he wasn't working in the field, he'd work at a sawmill. He would get 50 cents a day from sunup until sundown. So that'd be a 2 days' work to get the watch going at $1 per trip. So Mr. Overcash said he couldn't afford that. So he wanted to know how we would trade. Would we trade the old big 18-size Elgin that was running for a little gold Elgin that was not running? So we asked our dad what should we do about it. And he says, since you're smart enough to fix the watch, and we'll let you use your own judgment whether you should trade it off or keep it. Well, we decided we would make an offer. So we traded watches for $3 to boot. We traded the old 7-jewel, 18-size, nickel-cased Elgin for a little gold 15-jewel Elgin that wasn't running. We got $3 to boot. So we got the little gold watch going. It was the fall of the year. Dad sent us down to Cleveland with a bale of cotton to be ginned on the wagon. Of course, it's quite a long drive, and we got there. There was a lot of wagons ahead of us. So we had to sit and wait in line. Of course, like a couple of country kids, looking around, see what was different around here than what it was around on the old farm where there wasn't anything. So while we were sitting on the wagon, we noticed down in a shed by the side of a barn, there was a motorcycle sitting there, and it apparently hadn't been in use. There was this weeds growing up around it in this shed with a dirt floor. So I would watch the mules while Howard would go down and look it over. Then he'd watch the mules, I'd look it over. It was a nice-looking motorcycle, and we wondered why it wasn't in use. So we inquired around and found that the motorcycle belonged to a son of the owner of the cotton gin. Well, we asked him, was it for sale? Well, I guess he could see from our appearance we didn't have any money and thing. He says, what have you got to trade? Well, we've got a watch. Well, when he saw this watch, he was really surprised. And he fell in love with the little gold watch. And he says, I'll give you the motorcycle for the watch, but the motorcycle doesn't run. Says it doesn't have a magneto on it. So we traded. After we got our cotton ginned, we put this motorcycle up in the back of the wagon and headed for home. When we got home, Mom, she's about had a fit. Her boy's not going to have that thing around here. So when she found out it wouldn't run, well, we could run. We'd push one another around over the yard on it. Just we thought we had a motorcycle ride. So this went on for a little while, and we found an old Maxwell, which was a four-cylinder motor, had a similar type of a magneto. We took this magneto from the old Maxwell and mounted on the side of the motorcycle motor and made a leather coupling with shoe leather, that is sole leather, between the little shaft that come out of the motorcycle motor to the magneto. Well, the motorcycle was a two-cylinder, and the old Maxwell was a four-cylinder. So around the distributor, we'd put every other wire from the magneto to the spark plug. We got the motorcycle running. So our mind is all the time on our watchwork, but we didn't have anything to work with. But we found, in the meantime, there's a woman in Statesville whose husband had died at a young age. She was about 35 years old, and she had his workbench and tools, said she would like to get rid of to get some kind of a car to go to work. So we traded the motorcycle for a bunch of junk, you might say. There's very few automobiles around at that time, and very few drivers that knew how to drive a car. They wrecked them because they're practically new a lot of times. They didn't know how to take care of them. Everything went wrong, and they just junked their cars, and some of them almost new. So this Everett Troutman, he had a team of horses, and he'd pull these cars off of the road and take them to his little farm, and he would take enough parts from one, sometimes get another one going, or sometimes he'd strip them down where they had nothing left. So we got some of his junk had been stripped down. We got a frame and a motor and a differential, that is the gear under the back, a front axle, and we put this all together. We hauled it home in a two-horse wagon, took the old wagon we used to go to church in, and hauled this, all these old parts home. We got the frame set up, front axle under it and the back wheels under it, and got the motor in. And so we cranked up the motor after we got it in the frame, and my brother Howard, he got up on the seat, or on the gas tank, which is right under the front seat of a T-model Ford, but didn't have any body on it. So he got up under the steering wheel on the gas tank, and I cranked it for him. They didn't have starters in those days. So when you're going to back it out of the barn, it wouldn't go. It was just a grinding in the differential. So we took this differential apart and found the gears were stripped in the differential. So we took the gears back up to this fellow Troutman, and he gave us other gears that was in good condition. So when we put it together, we didn't know, not knowing anything about automobiles, watches, or anything else, but we had a strong desire to learn. So we learned by doing. We put this differential together with the pinion on the wrong side of the ring gear. So when we did, got it back together, we repeated. Howard got on under the steering wheel. I cranked it for him. He was going to back it out. When he put it in reverse, it run forward. I had to get out of the way real fast, but it went forward in reverse. By that time, my dad says, "Boys, it's time to get those mules to the plows." So, of course, we knew that was an order. We went on out in the field to work. So as we would get close in the field that afternoon, we would ask, "You got any ideas? What happened?" Finally, I said to Howard, I said, "You know, when you turn the crank right hand clockwise, that turns the drive shaft in the same direction. If that pinion in the back is on the wrong side of the ring gear, it will make it go forward if it's on one side. If it's on the opposite side, it would make it go back." So we took it apart, found that was the trouble. So we turned the third member, that is the spider gears and ring gear, over, put ring gear on the opposite side of the pinion, and that was it. So we drove that chassis around a little while over the farm, and of course we wasn't allowed to put it out on the road. Didn't have much road anyway, just dirt trails. The field's usually a better place to drive. So we drove around a little while, and we finally found a body where someone had went over a stump and busted the whole bottom of the motor and ruined the car. And the man's willing just to sacrifice anything he'd get out of it. So we bought that body for $2.50. My dad lent us $2.50 to buy that body. We put it on this car, on the chassis, painted it up, and took it up and traded it for that watchmaker's bench. She wanted $450, her first asking for it, which that was, we never thought, never heard of that much money. Our dad never had that much money. So we just wondered how we'd ever get it. In fact, we didn't think we ever would. But when we was able to trade the car for the bench, it had a closed top, you could covered bench, had a Wolf John lathe powered with a foot wheel underneath, a big heavy flywheel with a treadle, kind of like the old sewing machine, to get it in motion. Of course, the centrifugal force of it had no trouble keeping it going. That was the power for the lathe. We didn't have any electricity, no little electric motors at that time. So this lathe for making parts. And there was a nice staking tool which put in balance staffs and press hairsprings on and things of this type. Cost more than $100 at the time. Of course, the lathe was worth a lot more. And there's a lot of small tools and a few old watches in the drawers of the bench. So all in all, we thought we was really set. So the neighbor began to bring in watches and clocks. Of course, we had figured out from having a mechanical mind that power starts someplace and it drives the line of train all the way through. True with the automobile or tractor or anything else. Your power starts at a place and it one part makes another part act, and that makes another one act all the way down the line. So we learned the principle, all right, of what made them work. But we knew nothing about setting adjustments. So far as in play on the very delicate parts, setting pallet jewels, roller jewels, leveling hairsprings, and the many things went into fine adjustments. We knew nothing about these things. We get the watches going, and they would work. But it's kind of like you'd put up an automobile motor and leave the inserts out of the bearings. It would run, but it certainly would fly all to pieces after a time from all of the slack it had. Well, anyway, we didn't make any charge for a lot of it. We were getting experience, and in our neighborhood, we like to do things for one another. Just like on the farm, if someone was sick, their farm needed to be planted out, the neighbors did it. If they needed working out, the neighbors took care of it, harvest or whatever. Well, anything we could help one another with, that's what we did. So we find people had watches and clocks wouldn't run. Well, we tried to get them going for them without charge. Of course, there's no profit in that, but we learned more and more of the background of these things. We felt kind of proud of ourselves. We started with the old watch that was found in the new ground. We got it working, traded for the gold watch, and traded the gold watch for the motorcycle. Got the motorcycle working, traded it for enough junk to put up a car, traded that for the workbench and tools. So we felt that we was at least recognized as being somebody with the knowledge to do things. So when I got to be about 19, 20 years old, I wanted to get a job to make a little money, which we never had any money. So I would walk to Statesville, to Mooresville, different places to try to find a job, but there was far more jobs and far more people for jobs than there were jobs. So I'd walk all the way to Statesville and back and come back by Troutman's, and they were building an addition on the cotton mill at Troutman's that they'd built a few years before, and some extra houses for extra help to live in. So I said to Mr. Brown, he was the foreman there and actually a friend of my dad, and asked him if there's any hopes of me getting on, getting a job. He says, I've got more men here than I can pay now. He says, Money is so scarce. I said, more people want jobs than we can possibly pay. I said, we could use help, but we can't afford to pay them. I said, I'd like to work for a week as a tryout, see if I can qualify. And if you don't think I can qualify, there'd be no hard feelings. Don't give me anything. But I'd like to find out if I can qualify. So Mr. Cale, the owner of the mill from Charlotte, was standing there. Of course, I didn't know Mr. Cale. He turned around and says, Brown, if that boy wants a job that bad, give him a job. And Mr. Brown says, okay, Mr. Cale, if it's what you say. So I determined I was going to do as good work and qualify as much as any man they had. So I succeeded in doing so. I would watch the folks that was doing the particular work, see how they did it, and I was determined to do it just as well as they did. So we finished the addition on that cotton mill, which is about 100 feet square. The mill was 200 feet long and 100 feet wide. We built another 100 feet on the end of it. So when we finished that, we built a bunch of new houses to for extra help to live in for the new addition of the mill. So we'd sit around and at lunchtime and eat our lunch out of a paper bag. And Mr. Brown, somehow or another, took a liking to this kid, Jim Compton, and we'd talk about the carpenter square. So he taught me just about all of the numbers on a carpenter square, what they meant, what they were used for, and so on. So I got where I could cut stairways, rafters, or any kind of angles just about as well as anyone. I learned a lot with no education. Back in that day and age, we had a 6 months free school. You could go to school if you wanted to. If you didn't, you were not compelled to go. Well, it seemed that we got our wheat sowed and the cotton in, the corn gathered and everything. Part of the school was over. In the spring of the year, it's time to fix cotton land. That we didn't go to school much then, so my natural education was very limited. But we have a lot to be thankful for. We were blessed with a mechanical mind, just to learn to do most anything, and we learned by doing. So we finished that job, and Mr. Brown says, Jim, says, you've been a good boy, so you've been a good hand. He says, I have a contract to build a theater at Davison College, which was about 12 miles away between Mooresville and Charlotte. And he says, it's going to be about a month till I get the papers and everything ready to start work. He says, if you want a job, you've got a job already engaged. So I felt real good about having a job and engaged, but it'd be about 30 days before we'd start to work. But in the meantime, I'd met one of the most wonderful girls in the world. Beautiful little girl with a baby face, light brown hair, weighed about 115 pounds, a beautiful figure. But the most of all, she's humble, kind, one of the nicest girls I think I'd ever met in all of my life. So we'd went together for a little while, and I had saved up a little money, and I bought a car, the first car, first new car I had. Went to Statesville, and they had a new Chevrolet all polished up in the showroom. So I bought that car for $606. And, of course, I bought it on time. It cost me, I think, it's $30-odd a month for about a year and a half to pay for it. But I felt I was really fixed up with a wonderful girl and a new car. So in the meantime, all waiting for this job, I had an opportunity to come to Washington to see some relatives of mine. In fact, my brother Howard had already come to Washington, and he's working at my uncle in a drugstore. My uncle had a drugstore on 22nd Street, and my brother Howard was working for him. So I come up, and the next morning after we got to Washington, I was just sightseeing around, walked into this little jewelry store, and told this old man something about my background of working on watches and clocks. And he says, by golly, you want a job? And I says, yeah, I'd like to have a job. So he started me off at $24 a week. That was really hitting the numbers, from $13 a week, 10 hours a day hard labor, for a job in a jeweler's store where there's no labor. So I thought I was really well fixed. This was in the summertime. So Christmas time, I went back home. I was the most lonesome guy in the city of Washington, even though I felt wonderfully well blessed to have a job making this much money. So I went back Christmas, and we got married. So my wife come with me back, and of course, she was my real companion, willing to share the hard luck with us. We lived in one room, each slept, cooked and eat all in one room, and shared a bathroom down the hall. It's the only thing we could afford. So she stuck with me, and what little bit we could save, she would go to the 5- and 10-cent store and buy cook pots, plates and dishes and things to start housekeeping, everything we could save. She used it for a real good purpose. She's had better judgment in this type of thing than I had. So we were there for about 6 months, and of course the Depression's coming on at that time. There's a lot of new houses that people would like to buy, but they had no money. So we was fortunate enough to get into a new row house for $40 a month with no down payment as rental for a while. And if you stayed a certain period of time, they would consider you'd accumulate enough equity for a small down payment and you could buy the house. Well, that's what we did. We bought the house, stayed there long enough, we qualified and bought the house. Then that was in 1928. So in 1934, we bought the lot, the house where we now live at this time. 1936, we built on it. With the knowledge I'd learned from working the carpenter trade, I built the house myself. We drew the plans, figured up how many brick, how much lumber and material and everything it would take. Then I got estimates on my material. But at that time, if you buy $1,000 worth of material, $1,000 worth of labor would put it up. But I couldn't get anyone who would go in a mile of that. So I decided I would hire my bricklayers and hire my carpenters and all, and I bought my material wholesale, and we put up the house ourselves and saved a lot of money. But getting back to the watch shop, my brother and myself, we were real proud of having the opportunity to work there, and we'd won the confidence of this old man to the point where he trusted us all the way, and we were real proud of that, and we wanted to be trusted. So the next summer, after we had been there for a year, he wanted to go back to Switzerland, where he come from. See, he grew up in Switzerland and worked in the major watch factories from the age of 15 years old to the age of 40. So when he was 40 years old, the Gruen watch factory moved a branch to Cincinnati, Ohio, to Time Hill, Cincinnati. So he come over to help to start the Gruen watch factory. So when World War I broke out, he was drafted for a language interpreter. He mastered 7 different languages very fluently. So he was drafted to come to Washington as a language interpreter. So his office was next door to General Pershing's in the building. It's now the executive building, the office building for the White House, which is across the street from our place. So he worked there until the war was over. Instead of going back to the Gruen watch factory, he decided he'd start a watch repair shop in Washington, since he'd learned to know many of the dignitaries, congressmen, senators, and so on, and they talked a lot about the timepieces and their experiences in them. So he decided he would stay and set up a watch repair shop, which he did. So after we'd been with him for a year, he wanted to go back to Switzerland, and he trusted us to run the store. Well, we were determined to operate the store just as it was if he was there himself. So we would work long hours to try to keep everything when we close the season, want it ready to open tomorrow. So we were so thankful to have a good job. We didn't charge any overtime. We just accumulated everything we could for him, and what we could save up. We would buy material cabinets and tools. Sometimes we'd have to buy on time to get a bargain in certain material cabinets. So at that time, watches like the Elgin, Waltham, Hamilton, and Rockford, and many good standard American watches. So we bought a material cabinet that had material for each model. One piece of material of everything. When we used that piece out, we'd replace it with three different parts. So we're accumulating stock of material and tools to be used for our future. So this went on for a couple of years. We were so happy to have this old man. He was a real dad to us to get us started, and we got along fine with him in the store. For a couple of years, we had accumulated quite a lot of tools and material.